Our next presenter this morning is Dr. Cynthia Rand. Dr. Rand's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Rochester, and today she'll be presenting Fitting It All In, Incorporating New Adolescent Vaccines into Preventive Care Visits for Adolescents.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate your attention for this last workshop session, the last talk. I think there's a closing plenary right after that. And just, I know you've heard this background quite a bit, but just to add a few more vaccines in there, since 2005, I actually found 6 new recommendations. Oops, it's going to be automatic, so I have to slow it down. For adolescent vaccination, including the meningococcal, Tdap, hepatitis A for high-risk adolescents, HPV for females, and varicella vaccination, as well as the universal influenza vaccination. And those are all the MMWR dates when the vaccine recommendations become official. But other recommended preventive services for adolescents include multiple counseling or anticipatory guidance topics. And just a smattering of them include exercise, nutrition and eating disorder counseling, tobacco, drug, and alcohol use prevention, injury and violence prevention, STI and HIV and pregnancy prevention, as well as mental health and school performance discussions with providers. In addition, adolescents should be getting physical assessments, including measurements of their blood pressure, their BMI or body mass index, a full physical exam, as well as screening. New screening recommendations came out for cholesterol screening last year based on family history and overweight status. Chlamydia screening and HIV screening for sexually active adolescents is also recommended. So the objectives of our study were to understand how physicians are accommodating the new vaccines, to assess whether there's a change in topics discussed with new vaccinations to provide, to evaluate whether the amount of time spent with adolescents has changed with new vaccine recommendations, and to determine whether physicians perceive new vaccines as a hook for delivery of other preventive services. So we used purposeful sampling of 31 physicians from 18 primary care offices. They included pediatric and family medicine practices, about half and half of each, private hospital-owned and HMOs, as well as community health centers, and we included rural, urban, and suburban practices. So we used a 21-question semi-structured survey. The interviews were conducted over the telephone. They were taped and transcribed verbatim, and we used Atlas software to code our responses. We had 2 independent coders, and we applied content analysis where codes are sorted into categories and then organized into clusters or themes to really look at what providers were telling us. So first, to understand how physicians are accommodating new vaccines, the primary issues that arose were the visit type for vaccination, various office processes that they were using, and then attitudes toward vaccination, both physician attitudes toward delivering vaccines and parent receptiveness about accepting these new vaccines. So I'm going to give you some quotes from providers, and bear with me, they're a little bit long on the screen for each of these issues. So for visit type, the 3 types of visits that we heard about were either providers giving vaccines at well-child visits only, or giving specific types of vaccines at acute visits, or giving any vaccine at an acute visit. So for giving vaccines at well-child visits only, one rural family practitioner said, "The vaccines are being given at visits that are scheduled as well-child visits. Most of the time, if they were there for a problem-oriented visit, and I saw that vaccines were needed, it's also because they haven't had a preventive visit. So I'll say, you know, they haven't had a well-child check for the last 2 years. It's a good idea to schedule that, and I'm more likely to ask them to come so I can cover all the things, not only immunizations, but all the other preventive issues." And we heard this not infrequently, I would say, that people really preferred to give vaccines at well visits. And then others would say they would give certain vaccines at acute visits, but not others. So another family practitioner from a community health center said, "Of course they're minors, so to get the vaccine, they still need the parent to come in. So we generally do it more around the well visits. I would have to say Gardasil almost always is just around the well visit because of the length of time it takes, and because we'll be talking about some of those things, including sexual practices, sexual activity during the well visit. If it's some other acute visit, but the nurse notices that they're due for their tetanus booster, then we will offer it at any visit. And we did hear this, that meningococcal vaccine and tetanus vaccine, some providers would offer at acute visits, but not that first Gardasil vaccine. And then others would vaccinate at any visit. I try and review immunizations, even if they come up in for 6 visits, just to see if they're up to date. With our electronic medical records, it's pretty easy to glance at their entire immunization record, so you can see what's missing and what's not. Usually, I try to work it into every single visit unless they're not agreeable to it. If they're upset or if they're concerned about something or if they're just too ill to receive it anyway, then I don't bother. And then office processes. And the most common method that people told us they used is that the nurse screens the vaccine record, they give the VIS forms, the physician discusses the vaccine with parents, and then often the parents leave the room and the counseling occurs with the adolescent, and then the nurse gives the vaccine at the end of the visit. There are a few exceptions to this that I'll talk about, but this was a common method for the procedure. So in one pediatric suburban practice, a provider said, before I even walk in the door, my nurse already knows what we like people to get, and she's already reviewed everything, and she's got written on top of the chart, the front sheet, what shots they're due for. And another example of using VIS, the nurse gives the parent the appropriate immunization sheets so they can be reading about it in advance. I usually meet with the child and parent together initially, and I send the parent out of the room, and while I've got the parent in the room, I try to talk about the shots and get permission for the things that we need. And then honestly, it doesn't change the rest of my visit. Even though you're given the handouts, it helps a little bit because the parent will have read it before they come in, but there's usually a lot of questions, and then I spend my usual time with the kid. And an example of waiting to give vaccines at the end. Time-wise, I leave it to the end because as soon as you mention shots, the kids start to get really anxious, increase the blood pressure, don't focus on what you're saying, and the first question they ask you is, am I going to get a shot? That's a question they want answered at the beginning of the visit. If you mention them in the beginning, forget about the whole session. All their focus is, am I going to get shots at the end? So I say, you know, I don't know. Let me tell you at the end, but let's talk. And then the attitude toward vaccination seemed to matter quite a bit. So physician attitudes varied from being matter of fact or flexible, and then parent receptiveness also varied. And a matter of fact attitude, a suburban pediatrician said, you know, it's not a decision for me. I think the immunizations are an automatic. I don't really think about them being something to consider. It's just going to happen. Mainly, I see other counseling and preventive services the variable. The variable is not whether they get the shots or not. If they come in and see me, they're getting the shots. And then a more flexible attitude. I try to address their problems and say, oh, did you know that you could get this one? And then if they don't seem as interested, then I say, well, I can give you the information about it and you can think about it. And then I will give them the VIS, but it's hard. I can't say that I do it every single time. It really depends on how much time I have. And then another flexible attitude from a suburban pediatrician. Most parents are opting to wait on the Gardasil. My attitude has been that that's reasonable. We're already giving 2 or 3 shots. You know, the risk for most 11-year-old girls aren't high, but we push it a little harder with the older girls. When I say older, I mean 13 and up. We do certainly encourage them to follow through on that. Again, we offer it starting at age 11 or 12, but most of them don't want it that young at that age. And then looking at parent receptiveness, two providers, one suburban and one urban, said, I think it's going very, very well. We get, for the most part in this age bracket, a really compliant set of parents. There's very little discussion involved. They'll say to me, well, what do you recommend? You know, what I'd do if it was my kid. And another urban provider said, in the clinic, I have to say, the parents are very responsive to immunizations, and they don't ask a lot of questions. They basically say, this is recommended? Okay. Most of the time, they're very into it, and they don't ask that much about it. So that was how providers are accommodating vaccines, the method they feel they're using or approaches they're using. And then we asked whether there's a change in topics discussed with the new vaccinations to provide. And the issues that came up were, yes, we feel like we are shortchanging some topics. No, we haven't changed our topics at all. Or yes, Gardasil is the thing that changes our discussion. So some examples of that are, it can have an effect. If you feel pressured and you're falling very far behind, it's one more topic. I can see the topic not being discussed. Not if it was something they brought up or something they checked on their GAPS form, but maybe something else. You know, like, do you wear a seatbelt or something? That might go out the window. If I'm half an hour behind, it's possible. And another comment, it affects the amount of time anytime a new guideline comes out, whether it's an immunization or yet another piece of the anticipatory guidance or counseling puzzle we're supposed to deal with. You know, something else gets shortchanged, there's no question. And another comment, I'm probably not going into as in depth in some other areas. You know, you've got to limit the amount of time. This is something that's concrete. They're there, they need it, so it's a good thing to cover. It's got to protect them for a long period of time, rather than trying to work your way through their life and getting, oh, everything's fine answers. At least this is something you're concretely doing. Then others felt there was really no change in the topics that they discussed. And so one quote from a suburban pediatrician, another from a rural pediatrician said, we would discuss STIs anyway, but they're more likely to listen since we're actually giving them a shot against them. And another said, I don't think that really affects it. I pretty much have my standard spiel that I do, and that covers both of those things, vaccines and anticipatory guidance, and I don't feel like it's impacted. But others said, yes, Gardasil really changes this discussion. Just with the HPV vaccine, that does probably. I don't want to say it changes what I talk about, but it definitely is another way to talk about it, about sexual activity, and it's kind of encouraging these young girls to be abstinent until they're older and smarter. The parents are real touchy about it, so I try not to. They don't want to go into it. Especially when they're 11 or 12, they really don't want me talking to their little girl about sex. I think we talk more about development, and as they get older, then we talk about waiting. You know, it's always an awkward subject. And other comments about Gardasil changing the discussion. Yes, definitely. I mean, that's one of the beauties besides Gardasil, what it does for us. Opens up topics to talk about sexually transmitted diseases, and they're listening. I think the availability of Gardasil, what I think it might do is, they have us bring up the issue of cervical cancer and HPV in a patient who may not yet be even sexually active. So it gets us probably talking about that at maybe a sooner age. But because we use the GAPS form, and that includes a lot of that, I think we were doing some of that already before. And then a primary issue that physicians discussed was time. And we asked them, has the time that you spend with adolescents changed? And their responses ranged from, yes, we have changed the time we spent with adolescents. No, we are not scheduling anything differently. We have not changed the time at all. There was an effect on some providers that they were running behind, moving faster, losing personal time, an effect they felt on the nurses. Again, the Gardasil explanation time came up, and a few providers told us that this was a really stressed system. So when we ask about the time it takes to discuss new vaccines, generally the range that providers felt was about 3 to 10 minutes for discussion of vaccines. And a couple of practitioners told us that the first year was much worse, but now they feel that they're really caught up. We're actually at a point now where it's heavenly because most of the kids are coming in and we did them all last year, said one suburban provider. And another said it was a big deal the first year we rolled out Gardasil because it was affecting all teenagers. So it was the conversation we were having all the time. Now that it's just that one visit when you're doing it, it's hard to say it affects the grand scheme of things. So these were providers that felt they really saw their adolescents every year and they got a lot out of the way the year before we asked them. Others said, no, it really doesn't change their time at all. I don't think substantially. I think that probably the time they're in the office is extended, but the time that they spend with the physician is similar. I think that we've probably talked through most of the stuff before they get to the nurses, but I don't think talking is substantially different, and I think that the immunizations need to be touched on, but they don't take over a huge amount of time to talk about. And then the effect on providers. It ends up putting me farther behind because I think I still talk about all the risk stuff, and if I have to spend another 2 minutes talking about why hepatitis A and why the chickenpox booster, so then I'm farther behind. And another provider said, I have fought against shortchanging my time with the patient, which is probably why I run behind. Other issues that came up, I probably talk and move a little faster. To be honest, nobody is allotting me any more time to see these, or I run a little more behind if I happen to have more than one adolescent physical in one time block, which is unusual. So it seemed different for family practitioners because they're usually seeing fewer adolescents in a day compared to pediatricians. And I have no personal time. I mean, there's no time for much of anything else right now. I don't know, we just do it. Several commented on the effect on nursing time. Where it's been adding time for us and slowing us down probably is both in terms of counseling and then in terms of the nursing administration time. Another said, my nurses do that. They've changed the amount of time they spend with adolescents, but not me. And another, so I don't think it makes a big difference. I think it makes staffing and a large amount of work that needs to be done on part of the nurses a little tricky, so they just have a bigger workload to do. And then the Gardasil explanation time definitely came up. I would say the only major barriers are with HPV. It's parental misconception. So that is the significant thing I run into. That is where I have to spend most of my time. Just the Gardasil. It's really controversial, especially kids, the really Christian families. That'd be the ones that really object to it the most. But I have this really good handout, actually, that I give out. I often will give my spiel and then say, well, we don't have to decide today. Here's a handout that answers lots of different questions that parents might have, and why don't you just think about it? And then one provider talked about this very stressed system. But it has stressed the system, no question about it. It stressed the system a lot. I mean, there are times where people, you know, in our practice, we'd like to just throw up our hands and say, listen, let's not immunize anybody. I only heard this from one provider, so that's good. And then we looked at the effect on adolescent visits. We wanted to know, is this a hook to bring teens in for preventive services? And the three issues that came up were a school requirement that does bring in teens, or that immunizations really are not acting as a hook, and generally that it's hard to get teens in for care. So related to the school requirement, and in New York you need a Tdap to enter sixth grade. Because it's mandatory, Tdap, to have at sixth grade, before, while we would say we should see them every year, I would say 30% show up. Now you're seeing them at that visit at sixth grade because they have to get it, and then you can say, set it up for the next year, and then talk about coming back the year after and so forth. So you're trying, you're doing a little better about seeing them, and they are a little more used to it, and the parents are a little more used to, yeah, I should bring them in every year. So that sounded very positive. But at others about the school requirement said, I don't think it's a huge increase because they aren't mandatory, the Menactor or the Gardasil, but I think the Tdap is for sixth grade. So several felt they were seeing more sixth graders, but not beyond sixth grade. And then not acting as a hook was a common theme. No, I don't think so. I think that with HPV vaccine, they may hear about it on the TV, but most of the time with my population, they don't come in specifically for their vaccines. It's usually another motivation. And I think the numbers are the same, but you know they come in more often for three shots. Another said, I don't think I get calls from people saying, I need to get my Gardasil, therefore I will come in for my routine physical, any more than I would have gotten a call saying they need their routine physical anyways. I think it used to be nice, sort of, that people thought about Menactra as being something to get before college, because it brought the kids in for their college physicals. In a sense, to have the Menactra now be given younger, it might make it a little bit more difficult to get the kids in at the pre-college visit. And this is the only provider I heard mention that they were concerned about the effect on later visits by giving vaccines at the 11 to 12-year-old visit. And about it being difficult to get teens in. No, I haven't. That population's tough getting in for their routine visits. So a lot of time we'll catch them for an acute issue and then remind them about other stuff and catch them at that time and try to get them in for a well visit. But you know, once they kind of go through the childhood stuff, it's a lot harder getting them in for the yearly checkup. And strategies that arose that providers suggested using or that had been successful for them, including using questions such as a GAPS questionnaire, the Guideline for Adolescent Preventive Services that's developed by the AMA, or another adolescent questionnaire that they had developed in their practice. Using chart prompts, both for checking that shots were up to date and to deliver specific anticipatory guidance topics. Using an EMR to be able to quickly look at the immunization record. Giving written information. Lots of people talked about using VIS forms, but other people used other resources as well. People discussed knowing their patients well made this a lot more feasible, having good continuity with patients. Using a real nurse doc team effort, where they really worked in as a unified team, and sharing the burden amongst the practice. So a few quotes about this were using the GAPS. And we do use the GAPS form, which I think helps a lot, because I definitely focus in on where I see their biggest concerns are, still touching base on all the other things briefly, but I don't focus on them if I don't have to. And about using written information, I try and give information, at least the vaccine information sheets, and if there isn't time or they don't have time, I try and tell them to read it over and get back to me, or I'll try and have them come back for a follow-up visit, especially if it's an acute visit for, say, a pneumonia or an injury. Then often I can see them back in a 2 or 4 week period for follow-up from the original complaint and then hit them up again. And the shared burden. My practice is very strange versus some other practices, that the physicians aren't paid on productivity per individual, but paid on productivity for the whole practice. So So if I see a billion sick calls a day, but my wife is another physician, we'll see much less numbers, but see really complicated adolescents. We, everyone supports each other, so there isn't the pressure for the individual physician to force through. So conclusions that we can find from these qualitative surveys are the HPV vaccine really changes the discussion and takes time. And the biggest burden for some practices was really in the first year of HPV vaccination, and they felt that it was better now. Most providers don't feel they give up many anticipatory guidance topics, but they do give up personal time or they move more quickly. And it seems that questionnaires such as GAPS help identify vital issues, and vaccine recommendations don't bring in teens except for those required for school. Limitations are that it's a local study, it might not be generalizable to other areas, and the time spent, the number of patient visits, the immunizations, and the anticipatory guidance were not measured, and we don't know if physicians are over or under reporting what they're actually doing. So implications of this study are that education outside the physician's office about HPV vaccine could potentially save MD time in the long run. Implementing an adolescent questionnaire might help efficiency and help you to target counseling. Having additional school mandates would likely bring in teens, but only for specific ages for which the vaccine was mandated. And to deliver preventive care for teens, practices actively need to bring in teens outside of school mandates. And I'd like to thank my colleagues at the University of Rochester and Allison Kennedy at the CDC for their support with this project. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Cindy and to both of our speakers this morning. I'd like to now open up the floor for questions or discussion on the presentations. If you could please step to the microphone and let us know where you're from.
Hi, Shannon Stokely from CDC, and thank you both of you for those presentations. For Cindy, I was really interested in many of the quotes from the physicians. It sounded like they would provide information to parents, but then tell them to think about it and come back later, as opposed to giving a really strong recommendation for the vaccine. And I'm wondering, during your interviews, were you able to ask them, like, how frequently do parents come back? And is that an issue? Because my concern is, we know the physician recommendation is really important, and if we're letting them get out the door, how likely are they to come back?
I think that's a really good question. I didn't ask them that. I did ask about if they had methods in place for recalling teens for second and third doses of HPV, and maybe half the practices did, I would say. The people who were a little more adamant, I'd say, about it, felt like they really could get it in. If they weren't specifically offering particularly HPV at 11 or 12, they really thought they could get it in at 13. But the ones who otherwise seemed very flexible about their attitudes and they gave them information, I didn't really get the feeling that they were going to do anything actively to bring back teens and make sure that vaccine got in. That's a good point.
Hi, I'm Peggy Howe from Oklahoma. I have two questions. One, did any of the physicians consider coding for counseling when they did vaccine counseling with their patients and parents? That would actually increase their monies, because there is a way that you can code for counseling.
I'm not sure. I know you can code. I'm not sure if all our insurers will reimburse. I'm looking at Stan Schaefer. I'm pretty sure in our area it's not reimbursable even though there's a code. So it didn't come up as a strategy at all.
And then there were some physicians that, you know, didn't really press the fact that encouraging the HPV vaccine for these young girls before they become sexually active, which is really the reason why they want to give this vaccine. I think in one of your studies, you know, it was like, well, we don't want to give it this early at 11 and 12. And if you look at the sexual activity of young girls, you know, you really want to catch them before they're sexually active. And to me, that would be something that the physicians would really want to encourage before they're sexually active, which is what the recommendation is.
Right. I think they were really split, so I tried to give you a smattering of opinions. So I think there were certain physicians who, the matter-of-fact ones, who would say, this is what we need to do, this is why we need to do it, we're doing it. And so that approach seemed that they really didn't have a problem. They knew their patients well and their patients trusted them. And then I tried to give you examples of the other side where, yes, they were much more flexible about it and they were happier. They talked about it with their patients, but I think they really relied on the information they gave patients instead to discuss the specifics. So the handouts that they gave, both the VIS or some of them used pharmaceutical handouts, some of them used others they found on the web or from other resources. I tried to pinpoint what resources they had and they had a hard time telling me exactly what they used or where it came from. But I think they relied on those written resources to explain it more than they did, the ones that were flexible about it. The ones that were really more either, you might say, paternalistic or just really pro-vaccine, then did explain that this is why we need to get it in early.
And do they any of them use nurse visits to just bring those patients back for their second or third dose where they don't have to see the physician?
Universally, every single practice, nobody saw the teen for the second or third vaccine in the people that we interviewed. Every follow-up vaccine was given at a nurse-only visit, unless it was a practice that vaccinated at acute visits, and then sometimes they would give follow-up vaccines at acute visits, but they never would plan to see the patient back with the physician for a follow-up visit.
Okay, thank you.
All right, are there any more questions for our speakers this morning? We have some time. Any comments anyone would like to share on, you know, your experiences in the office setting with adolescents or how the uptake of these vaccines has played out? Don't see anyone. Well, then I'd like you to join me in thanking our speakers one more time this morning.